Well, the passage we read is stacked full of things that we no doubt come across every day in and around Southampton and Netley. Self-harming idol worshippers, rain gods, bolts of lightning from heaven, animal sacrifices. Although it is a Sunday school favourite that's familiar to many of us, I'm sure, that the sheer strangeness of this passage, I think, should immediately provoke a couple of questions which we really need to begin by answering this morning. Firstly, is this even true? Did this even happen? And secondly, if it is true, then is it relevant to us anyway? Well, let's briefly just think about those two questions. Firstly, is it true? Well, the events described are strange, and they did happen a long time ago. So the question must be, can we trust what's written here in this chapter? Well, there's loads that we could say about that. But I think if we look at verses 19 and 20, they can help us with a quick answer, at least, to this question. In those verses, then the prophet Elijah is talking to King Ahab, and he says, "Now summon the people from all over Israel to meet me on Mount Carmel, and bring the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Asherah who eat at Jezebel's table." So Ahab sent word throughout all Israel and assembled the prophets on Mount Carmel. So these verses, well, they categorically tell us that there was nigh on a whole nation of people who were eyewitnesses to these events. Assuming fairly, I think that what happened in this chapter would have been pretty unforgettable and would have been a story you'd want to tell your children and your grandchildren. Then the writer of the Book of Kings would have had a few letters of complaint, I think, if he'd have twisted the facts here, or if he'd got what happened wrong in his description. There's certainly no way that 1 Kings 18 could have been established as a reliable historical record unless it was truly an accurate account. There were simply too many people who knew what had happened that day, what had really happened, for him to be able to get away with fudging the facts. This event was just too public for that to happen. So I think we can be confident that however strange these events might seem to us, they did take place as are described here. But what does that matter anyway? What does it matter if they're true? Surely the context and the culture of these events is so far removed from today, isn't it? So strange to us, so foreign to us, that even if it is true, then why on earth should we care? Why is it relevant? Why spend time looking at this? Well, let's take a closer look at the cultural context here and see what we actually find. For a few years now, before this chapter, Israel has been under the rule of the morally questionable King Ahab and his wife, Queen Jezebel, who is certainly more than a match for her husband in terms of her zeal for all things cruel and terrible. But their reign had overall been characterized by their introduction of a new range of idols. And we read about this at the end of chapter 16. If you just flick back to chapter 16, and we get this kind of introduction to Ahab's reign over Israel. Look there at verse 30. "Ahab, son of Omri, did more evil in the eyes of the Lord than any of those before him. He not only considered it trivial to commit the sins of Jeroboam, son of Nebat, but he also married Jezebel, daughter of Ethbaal, king of the Sidonians, and began to serve Baal and worship him. He set up an altar for Baal in the temple of Baal that he built in Samaria. Ahab also made an Asherah pole and did more to provoke the Lord, the God of Israel, to anger than did all the kings of Israel before him." Now, idolatry wasn't a new thing by any means to Israel. The past seven chapters of 1 Kings have been a tale of the nation falling into the grip of idol worship. But we're told here that Ahab and Jezebel, they really took this to a whole new level. Effectively, they've established in Israel what we'd call today a pluralistic culture. It's a culture where a multitude of options are on offer to nourish the spiritual appetite of the people. It's worth pointing out that the Baal actually refers to a collection of deities, the Baals, a variety of gods. And we're also told in those verses we read that Asherah, who is like Baal's sidekick, if you like, was promoted as another alternative. There was a whole spiritual menu available, with the only exception, the only religion excluded, being the one that claimed exclusivity. That is the worship of Yahweh, the God of Israel. So this story, it's set in a pluralistic culture where any and every variety of religion and spirituality is on offer, with the only belief system that's frowned upon being the one which claims that all other belief systems are wrong. I'm sure that sounds fairly familiar to us. It's a description of the religious climate we're in today, isn't it? And so suddenly this passage, which is so foreign to us in so many ways, suddenly becomes strikingly relevant to the situation we're in today. And we can see that the people of Elijah's day were faced with the same questions as people today are faced with. Namely, which God should I follow? And why does it even matter anyway? And those are the questions that are at the heart of this passage that we're looking at this morning in chapter 18. Elijah sets up this God contest. The invitation is made to Ahab and to his prophets in verses 16 to 20. And then the challenge is then made to the people in verse 21. The rules of engagement are stipulated and then ratified in the next few verses after that. Everything is prepared for this great showdown. Forget X Factor or Strictly Come Dancing. This was live competition on a cosmic scale. Viewing figures were through the roof as the whole nation were on the edge of their seats. All of this was arranged to answer the question, who is the real God? Who should the nation follow? Well, before we look at how the candidates measured up in this contest, I want us to see that this is a question that really matters. It really matters which God you follow. It's a question that impacts on every single one of us here. Because the truth that the Bible presents to us time and time again is that everybody worships something. Every single one of us worships something. And you might say to me, well, I'm not a religious person, really. And that's quite a common view that's expressed today, isn't it? But when the Bible says that everyone worships something, it's not primarily talking about religion. It's talking about the orientation, the direction of our hearts. Now, that might seem like a strange thing to say, so hopefully we can see what I mean by that. If we flick back to 1 Kings chapter 11, so we're going back even further this time, to chapter 11. Chapter 11 of 1 Kings is really where the idolatry began in this stage in Israel's history. Up until the end of chapter 10, everything's been looking rosy. But then suddenly in chapter 11, that's the real turning point. The king at the time is King Solomon. And the trouble really starts with him. But look at how the start of the trouble is described. Let's look at verses 4 to 6 of chapter 11. As Solomon grew old, his wives turned his heart after other gods. And his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. Do you see how, right from the beginning, the focus is on the heart? It's a question of Solomon's heart. And when the Bible talks about the heart, it means the very core of our being. It includes our thoughts, our desires, our emotions. So it didn't really matter what the outward religion was that was going on in the nation of Israel at this time. That was just a symptom. The real problem was in the heart. It was a question of thoughts and desires and emotions and ambitions. So the question that this passage raises for us is not, are you religious? Or what religion do you follow? The question is, who or what does your heart belong to? So suddenly it becomes a question that affects every single one of us. It's a question that matters to all of us because we all have hearts. All of us have thoughts, desires, and emotions which are fixed on something. And the outward symptoms of that heart fixation are now very different, aren't they, from what they were in 1 Kings. No longer do we set up statues to our gods and bow down and scrape and grovel before them. We've developed much more sophisticated, much more subtle ways of worshipping our gods. So much so that we wouldn't even really call it worship, although that's exactly what it is. So, for example, when we're flooded constantly with images, with posters, music videos, magazines, DVD covers of beautiful people wearing beautiful things, and when those images seep into our minds and our souls, and we start to think that beauty equates to success and security and satisfaction, when we spend so much of our money, time and energy on making ourselves match up to whatever culture says is beautiful today, when young girls stop eating and young men can't commit to a relationship because they're spending their whole lives waiting for the perfectly formed woman, and anyone who isn't young anymore spends inordinate amounts of money making sure they still look like they are at least. Well, we wouldn't say we worship the God of beauty, but that's exactly what we're doing. Or when our spending always seems to expand to match our income so that we always need another pay rise. When the thing that gets us through the working day is the promise of the yachts or the house by the sea or the holiday in the Meds. When money managers commit suicide because the hedge fund has collapsed. The economy goes to pot because everyone has borrowed too much money from everyone else. Well, we wouldn't say we worship the God of money and success, but that's exactly what we're doing. Or when we'd spin a web of lies to our closest friends and family just to cover up a stupid mistake. When our first instinct is to point the finger at our absent colleague or the team in the other office when we've messed up at work. When we never dream of asking anyone in church how things are going spiritually for fear that they might fire the same question back at us. When every response and every conversation is calculated to make us come out looking good. But we wouldn't say we worship the God of our own squeaky clean reputation. But that's exactly what we're doing. Everyone worships something, whether it's family and children, career and making money, achievement, critical acclaim, saving face and social standing, maybe a romantic relationship, peer approval, competence and skill, secure and comfortable circumstances, your beauty, your brains, a great political or social cause, your morality and virtue, the emotional dependence of others on you, success in Christian ministry. It could be absolutely anything. But everyone worships something. In the book of Romans, the Apostle Paul, he puts it like this. He says, talking about every single one of us, he says, we have exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things, rather than the Creator who is forever praised. Amen. The great Swiss theologian John Calvin, he describes the human heart as a factory of idols. Our hearts constantly take good things and turn them into ultimate things, into divine things. So the point is that it does really matter which God you follow. It matters because this is an issue in which nobody, not a single one of us, sits on the fence. We can't sit on the fence on this question because everyone always worships something. Well, let's get back to Mount Carmel and to this God contest then. Now we've established that this question is important. Let's look at what's going on here. Well, according to Elijah's rule book for the contest, the clincher is fire. Look at the end of verse 24 back in 1 Kings 18. The God who answers by fire, says Elijah, he is God. So let's look at how the candidates fare then. And I want us to do this under two headings this morning. Firstly, how to recognize a false God. And secondly, how to turn back to the true God. How to recognize a false God and how to turn back to the true God. So firstly, how to recognize a false God. In verses 25 and 26, the Baal prophets, they set to preparing their altar. And what follows from then on is a frenzy of activity, which you can't help but read with a bit of a wry smile. It begins with shouting and then dancing in verse 26. But nothing happens. After a whole morning of this, Elijah begins to twist the knife, doesn't he? And his merciless taunting in verse 27 leads them to further fanatical excesses. The prophets start cutting and slashing themselves. Nothing happens. Lunchtime passes. The afternoon drags on. The sun begins to set below the horizon. And still nothing happens while this frenzy continues. The time for the bonfire to be lit comes around. Perhaps Baal's been waiting until it gets dark so that his fireworks display is all the more impressive. But still nothing happens. It's a bit of a bizarre and amusing scene, isn't it? Although tragic as well. We almost want to join in with Elijah's taunting as we read of what these prophets are doing. That is until we realise that our gods are no different. And that our heart's desires will lead us to the same excesses as these wild, fanatical Baal worshippers. How do you recognise a false god? Well, firstly, false gods make you dance. False gods make you dance. What does that mean? Well, if we think about it, what's essentially going on there in verse 26 is a performance. These prophets are putting on a show. They're dancing around the altar, but it's not for the benefit of the crowd. And it's certainly not for the benefit of Elijah. It's a performance for their God. It's for Baal. They're dancing for Baal. Well, why would they do that? That seems bizarre, doesn't it? Well, it's because it's what their God demands of them. It's what their idol asks of them. And the truth is, our gods demand the same thing of us. They make us perform. They make us dance to their tune. Steve's family were Christians. His friends were Christians. In fact, most of the people he knew were Christians. He'd been to church twice a week, plus the prayer meeting, of course, for as long as he could remember. He was the first kid in his youth group to pray in the church prayer meeting. He'd been on CU committee at uni. He'd led countless Bible studies, and he'd even brought his non-Christian friends along to church. But frankly, Steve was miserable. His whole Christian life felt like one long slog, and he never seemed to get anything in return. The problem was he couldn't tell anyone at church because everyone else seemed to be fine. What on earth would people think anyway if anyone actually knew how he really felt? Steve danced to the tune of the Baal of reputation. His whole life was a performance of keeping up appearances in front of his friends and family and church. How do you recognise a false god? Well, they make you dance. They make you perform. And secondly, they bleed you dry. False gods bleed you dry. The prophets go beyond performance. In verse 28, things are taken to a whole new level. Their behaviour becomes irrational. They're not just willing to go out of their way to perform for their God. They're willing even to harm themselves just to satisfy this deity. Just to get some kind of response out of him. Just to prove to themselves that in the end he's worth it. In the end, surely he'll come through for us. Sally had the misfortune of being born beautiful. Even in childhood, she saw the power that she could wield with her physical attractiveness. At first, she used her beauty to manipulate others, but eventually others used it to manipulate her. She came to feel that she was powerless and invisible unless some man was in love with her. She couldn't bear to be alone, And as a result, she was willing to remain in relationships with men who were even abusive towards her. The veil of love bled Sally dry. She'd go to any lengths, even let her own blood flow, just to be loved. Just to hold out for some security and satisfaction that it was all worth it in the end. How do you recognize a false god? So they make you dance and they bleed you dry. And then thirdly, they never give you what you're looking for. They never give you what you're looking for. The conclusion there in verse 29, it's so emphatic, isn't it? The author really rams this point home. Despite all the shouting and all the dancing and all the slashing and the blood flowing, verse 29, there was no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. These prophets had done everything that Baal had asked of them. They'd followed the recommended practice manual for Baal worship, and they'd even gone beyond that. But no response was forthcoming. They got nothing for their effort. Anna wanted desperately to have children. She eventually married and, contrary to the expectations of her doctors, was able to bear two healthy children despite her age. Her dreams did not come true. Her overpowering drive to give her children a perfect life made it impossible for her to actually enjoy them. Her overprotectiveness, fears and anxieties, and her need to control every detail of her children's lives made the family miserable. Anna's oldest child did poorly in school and showed signs of serious emotional problems. The younger child was filled with anger. There's a good chance her drive to give her children wonderful lives will actually be the thing that ruins them. Getting her heart's deepest desire may end up being the worst thing that ever happened to her. False gods never come through. The idols of our hearts won't bring the satisfaction we ask of them. They won't give us what we want or what we need. They can't give us the security, the love, the satisfaction that we demand from them, because they're not real gods. They don't deserve worship, so they can't stand up under the weight of our expectations when we do worship them. And so do we begin to see how foolish it is to hope for anything more from these idols. How crazy it is to build our lives on them, set our hearts on them. To do so is to set off on a road which ends only in, at best, constant disappointment. And at worst, permanent despair. Ultimately, all these idols can do is enslave us, make us perform their dance, bleed us dry, and leave us empty. It's no mistake that the word Baal in Hebrew means master or owner. That's exactly what these idols are. So how can we break free? How can we shake off this bondage? We all worship something. These idols are taking us nowhere. So how can we get away from that? Well, let's look secondly then at how to turn back to the true God. How to turn back to the true God. Eventually, Elijah takes pity on the prophets and he calls round one of the God contests to a close. Now it's the turn of Elijah's God, Yahweh, the Lord, the God of Israel. Elijah's keen to make sure that the victory is a decisive one. He doesn't want to leave room for a steward's inquiry or an appeal to the third umpire here. He wants the matter decided once and for all. In fact, the whole contest has been set up to provide this conclusive evidence that Baal is a counterfeit and that Yahweh is God. Look at how it's been set up. Well, there's a multitude of biased eyewitnesses. Bias towards Baal, of course, that is. Mount Carmel itself was probably a centre of Baal worship. This was Baal's territory. Baal is allowed to go first, and he's given all day to get in the mood. What's more, that the particular Baal under examination here was probably the god of thunder. Lightning bolts were his supposed speciality, so setting fire to an altar, well, that should have been right up his street, really. On the other hand, there was only one of Elijah. The altar he builds in verses 30 to 32, it's a bit of a pitiful repair job, but it unmistakably bears the stamp of Yahweh, the God of Israel. What's more, he has 12 jars of water thrown on the altar for good measure. I'm no physicist, but I was a sixer in Cubs, so I know that wet stuff doesn't burn well. And this altar was absolutely soaking, absolutely saturated. If Yahweh was going to win this contest, he'd have to come from 12-0 down in injury time in front of an away crowd. But if he did win, there'd be no doubt, none whatsoever, that this was the true God. And especially all the more given Baal's pitiful no-show earlier on in the day. So the time comes for the sacrifice to be lit. The tension's been building to this point. The writer gradually slows down the action. Notice how he does this. He describes every word and every move that Elijah makes from verse 30 onwards. And that leads us to Elijah's prayer in verse 36 and 37. Let's read them together. Look with me at verses 36 and 37. At the time of sacrifice, the prophet Elijah stepped forward and prayed, "O Lord, God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known today that you are God in Israel, and that I am your servant, and have done all these things at your command. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, so these people will know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you are turning their hearts back again." What's the purpose of Elijah's prayer? What's he asking God to do here? Well, it's there in verse 37, isn't it? He wants God to show that he's the real God and show the people that he's turning their hearts back to him. Here it is. It's the answer to that question, how to turn back to the true God. It's about to come. How can our hearts be turned back to the true God and set free from this futile pursuit of idols? Well, no sooner has Elijah finished speaking than the fire falls and everything on the altar is completely consumed by this fire. And the impact of that instant inferno, well, it's immediate. Look at verse 39. Look at what happens. When all the people saw this, they fell prostrate and cried, "The Lord, he is God. The Lord, he is God." Here's the answer to Elijah's prayer. Immediately, the people's hearts, they're beginning to be turned back to God, to the true God. Yahweh's made it clear by his fire that he is God and that he's turning their hearts back to him. If our hearts are truly to be turned back to God, if we really want to be set free from futile idolatry, we need the fire of God. It takes the fire of the Lord to turn our hearts back to him. Well, let's think about what that means. Well, firstly, we need the fire of a glorious God, the fire of a glorious God. What is it that so impacted on the people here? Why do they respond like this? It's because they've seen firsthand what Elijah had set out to prove. In the fire, they've seen that God, he's the real God. He's the glorious God. He's the worthwhile God, the worthy God. They've seen that he's the only one, only God there on Mount Carmel who's worth following, because he's the only God there on Mount Carmel who's actually real. But they never realized that until the fire fell. We'll never reason our way into worshipping God. It's not something we'll intellectually stumble across. Our hearts are just too attached to our idols. We cling to them too strongly. It takes the fire of God to fall in front of us, to singe our eyebrows, to wake us up to who he really is. It takes his fire to open our eyes to the truth, to shake us out of our idol addiction. That fire may come in many ways. It may come through circumstances in our life. It may come through God's tearing away from us every other idol that we cling to, because it's only when we have nothing but God that we realize we need nothing but God. It may be a painful fire, because it takes that much for us to see that only God deserves our worship and our trust. It may come in the form of a deep dissatisfaction with the idols this world thrusts before us. C.S. Lewis, a famous writer, once wrote that if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If you feel like that, then that may be the fire of God falling in your life. It may even be falling right now. But however it comes, it's the best thing for us. It's always the best thing for us, because it's the fire that sets us free. We need the fire of a glorious God, and we need the fire of a gracious God. Turn with me back very briefly just to Deuteronomy chapter 6. I've got a page up. It's on page 186 in the Blue Church Bibles if you're struggling. Deuteronomy 6. Just going to read a few verses. This Deuteronomy contains God's instructions to the people of Israel before they entered into the land of Canaan. This is what God was telling them about how they should live in that land. And let's read a few verses from verse 13. 1 Kings 6, verse 13. Fear the Lord your God, serve him only, and take your oaths in his name. Do not follow other gods, the gods of the peoples around you. For the Lord your God, who is among you, is a jealous God, and his anger will burn. Notice that word, burn, against you. And he will destroy you from the face of the land. This was God's warning, God's instruction to the people of Israel. And then flip back to 1 Kings 18. Let's go forward in time again. That's where we were. And with those verses in Deuteronomy 6 in mind, let's read again verse 38 of 1 Kings 18. Then the fire of the Lord fell and burned up the prophets, the people, King Ahab, Queen Jezebel, and everyone who was gathered on Mount Carmel that day, because they had followed the gods of the people around them. That's not what it says, is it? That's where the fire should have fallen. That's what should have happened. But the fire didn't fall there. Instead, we read that the fire fell on the sacrifice. What drove the people to fall down before God in verse 39 when the fire fell? Well, we've said it was a realization that God was the real God, the glorious God. But surely as well, it was a realization that the fire could have and should have fallen on them. It was a realization that only the grace of God, only his absolutely undeserved kindness, had kept the fire from falling on them. I don't think we can see this fire fall from heaven on Mount Carmel and help but lift our eyes to another mountain. Not Mount Carmel, but Mount Calvary. And see the fire of the Lord fall on another sacrifice. Only this time the sacrifice was perfect. This time the sacrifice was the only one whose heart has always been true to God. Anyone who never served an idol, the one whose whole being, heart, mind, soul and strength was utterly devoted to the worship of God every second of his existence. And didn't Jesus dance the dance of God? Didn't he perform perfectly for his Father in heaven? And didn't Jesus quite literally bleed himself dry in service of the true God? And then when he had done all that and cried out in agony on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me? There was, to quote 1 Kings 18, verse 29, no response. No one answered. No one paid attention. How can we be free of our idols? How can our hearts be turned back to the true God? Our freedom comes, our hearts are turned back when we realise that Jesus performed for God. He danced God's tune so that we don't have to. When we realise that Jesus bled himself dry for God so that we don't have to do the same. It's when we realise that because Jesus didn't get the answer he was looking for from God on the cross, then we can find the answer we're looking for in God because of the cross. We won't be free of our idols until we realise that if Jesus loves us that much, if that's the extent of his endless grace towards us, then we don't need to look anywhere else for security, for love, for satisfaction. Our hearts won't turn back to God until we see the irresistible beauty of Jesus in all of his self-giving, unconditional, bountiful, sacrificial love. She offers freely to everyone who will rest all of their hopes, their ambitions, their thoughts, their dreams, their hearts on him and him alone. We need the fire of her gracious love.